Are you ready to record? Great. Let me just mute everybody. Welcome everybody to the Yecheskel Shir. The Shir is Le'ilu Nishmos Ma'aseh Shmuel ben Avraham Ari HaKohen and Chaya Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel HaKohen on the Book of Yecheskel. Also dedicated to all our soldiers, as ever. We are holding in Yecheskel chapter 16, verse 18 and 19. That's what we're up to. Chapter 16, verse 18 and 19. This is an allegory. And we're up to the point in the allegory where God is explaining to the Jews how they've gone back on their promise, how they've misused all the goodness that God has given to them. Remember, the allegory is a foundling, a baby girl found in the field and drowning in her own birth blood. God picked her up and eventually married her and gave her gifts. And now she's turning her back on her husband. And so in verses 18 and 19, we're at the point where really the downhill spiral of the Jewish people really takes hold. And God says in, again, verses 18 and 19, chapter 16, Vatikri es bigdei rikmosech, vatachasim. You took your beautiful embroidered garments and covered and clothed them on male images, male idols. Vashamni uktarati nosat lifnechem. And you gave my oil and my incense to them. Vlachmi. And my bread, asher nosati loch, that I gave to you, soles, together with fine flour, b'shemen, oil, u'dvash, and honey, chaltich, that I gave you to eat, nesatihu lifnehem, you place them before them, you place these things before the idols, l'reach nichoach, to be a pleasant odor for the paganism that you indulged in. Vayehi. And so it was. Na'um Hashem Elokim. So says God. So this is the downhill spiral. And we know that the whole purpose of existence, certainly for the Jewish people, and really it's for the whole of humanity, the whole purpose of existence is to serve God, to emulate God, to become godlike. To become as godlike as we can, in order for us to achieve those lofty goals, God, of course, provides us with everything we need. So we have to reflect, on these gifts, that everything we need to serve God faithfully are gifts from God Himself. And the ultimate expression of our service of God occurs in the temple, and the Beis HaMikdash, and in contemporary terms, the Shul. Which is, as Yechezkel mentioned in chapter 11, Ve'ehi lohem ma'at. I've given them, I've become for them, I've provided them with a mini Beis HaMikdash, with a mini temple, a shul, in the lands where they have come to and have been exiled to. And to accomplish that purpose, to serve God, as we said, God provides everything we need to achieve that service. To achieve that connection to God, and therein lies the oddity of life and the oddity of God's methodology, that God gives us things for free on the basis that we return the favor, and either use them for his service or even return to him things directly. If you want to put it in the context of a parent and a child, something similar to a parent giving a child a gift on the basis that the child will return part of it to the parent as a gift. And if you look at it carefully in relation to God and even in relation to a parent, you ask yourself the question, does God really need us to return the gifts he has given to us? Obviously not. God doesn't need anything, doesn't want anything. So the idea here is that when God gives us things, gives us gifts, and we return some of them, some, all, or part of the gift that he gives us back to him, it's an expression of gratitude for what he has given to us. And even though the avodah, the service of God, is demanded by the Torah, the underlying message is that we learn the lesson of gratitude. The whole point of it is that we learn from it to be gracious and to thank people, which on the basis that we thank God, we can extrapolate that idea from showing gratitude to God and learn to have gratitude for other human beings. This is the whole point of the exercise, to learn. So that going back to the analogy of a child, when a child returns all or part of a gift he's received from a parent, it makes the parent feel good. Not because the parent wants or needs whatever the child gives him or gives her, but because the child is acknowledging a relationship and the child wants to reciprocate the love and appreciation in the only way he can, by returning part of what he's been given by his parent. He can't make or provide for himself. So everything he has is given to him. So in order to show some gratitude and acknowledge the relationship he has with his parents, he returns something, gives something back to them. And the point God is making here is that the gifts he gave us that were designed to allow us to reinforce our relationship with him have been used to establish a relationship with an idol. As verse 18 says clearly here, God says, "Vatikhi es big day rik moser, vatchasim, you took your beautiful embroidered garments, the clothes that I provided you, even the ones you use for my service in the base of Migdosh, the shimni, shamni, and the oil that's used in the base of Migdosh, uktarti, and the incense used in the base of Migdosh, nosati lifneha, and you use them to clothe, to pay homage, to offer sacrifices to idols." And the amazing thing is that, the oddity, the irony, the strangeness of God's approach is, despite the blasphemous misuse of God's gifts to us, which continue to this day, God continued and continues today to supply those very same gifts, almost as if nothing untoward had taken place, so that, we can turn our backs on God and he continues to provide us with life, with all the things we need, the food, the shelter, the roof over our head, protection. And the best example of this is seen in verse 19, the second verse in these two verses. There's a medrash here, a medrash in Kisisa. We read Kisisa a few weeks ago in relation to the golden calf. And you find that on the day that the Jewish people in the desert built the golden calf, erected the golden calf, manna still descended from heaven, as if not God's like continues to provide the food for you, as if nothing has happened. And the Medrash says, a very strange Medrash, the Medrash says the calf that came out of the cauldron, the golden calf that came out of the cauldron, was not inanimate. It moved around, it was animate, almost alive, and either it ate grass or it appeared to eat grass, just like a cow or calf would do, so that the great chutzpah of the Jewish people in the desert was that they took the manna that God had provided for them, that they picked up that morning, and brought it as an offering to the golden calf for it to eat. And as it says, and the Medrash quotes our pasuk, "V'lach mi asher nosati loch." Verse 19, our verse here, "The lach mi asher nosati loch, and my bread that I gave you, made out of fine flour, solas v'shemen u'dvash, made out of fine flour, oil and honey," which was the nature, the texture, and the original taste of the manna, hechaltich, that I gave you to eat in the desert, u'nesati u'lifneim l'reach nichach, you placed it before the golden calf, like for the golden calf to eat. And God says, what am I going to do with you guys? It would have been sufficiently shameful that had Israel sinned while God was performing miracles for them and giving them manna, but they did even worse than that and used the manna itself for idolatry, which is just, beyond belief, really. Furthermore, the last words of verse 19, "Vayehi, no Hashem Elokim." So it was, says God, meaning that the very fact that the Israelites used God's life-saving gift of the manna, of the man, the manna bread, for pagan practice, it would have been appropriate for God to say at that point, enough, guys, enough gifts for these ungrateful people. No more manna for you today or from today. That's the end of it. This is what you're doing. I give you gifts and you use it to, you know, bring the sacrifice and offering to a golden calf. What do you expect? You expect manna tomorrow as well? But the truth is, yes. Nevertheless, manna still descended from heaven the very next day to feed them. More than that, none of the other gifts that God provided them in the desert to protect them and make their lives comfortable ceased either as a result of the golden calf. Everything was carried on as normal, as if God said, oh, okay, you know, I'm not very pleased, but, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu made a plea on their behalf, and God says, okay, let's carry on. And this is something that Nehemiah writes about, the book of Nehemiah in the 9th chapter. Remember, Nehemiah is a very hard individual. And when he came back to the land of Israel from Persia, he came with some very strong views. And he makes the point here, this very point. This is in Nehemiah in chapter 9, verses 18 to 21. Ah, lehem egel masecha. Although they made for themselves a golden calf, a molten calf, and they praised the golden calf. This is the God who brought, they told each other, this is your God who brought you out of Egypt to the golden calf. And they committed great provocation against God. But, says Nehemiah, I can't really understand it. But atob rachamecha rabim, you God, with abundant mercy, lo azavtim, you did not forsake them b'midbar in the desert. Etz amud ha'onon lo samei aleihem, the pillar of cloud, you that protected them, the climate that controlled the climate, did not turn away from them. B'yomam during the day, lanchosam baderach, that led them on their way. Etz amud ha'esh b'layla, and the pillar of fire at night to illuminate them and keep them warm, and they could see where they were going, to make sure they carried on the right what road. And you gave your good spirit to try and make them understand. You did not withhold you did not withhold your manna from their mouths, and you gave them water to quench their thirst. But our boim shonakil kelter, and for 40 years you sustained them bamidbar in the desert. Lo choseirus salmosechem lo choseiru, you denied them nothing. Salmosechem lo bolu, Their clothes didn't wear out, raglehem lo botseku, and their feet did not swell. Now, if you think about this idea in the context of our own lives, you pass a McDonald's restaurant and decide to go in and have a cheeseburger. Now, God doesn't want you to do that. He could easily take away your ability to walk into the restaurant, your ability to eat the burger, remove the money from your pocket to be able to pay for the food. God doesn't do that. And why doesn't he do that? Because he's made a commitment. Because God's commitment to us and God's commitment to free will. And as the Gemara in Makkah says, "Baderach she'odam rotze leilech bo molichim osa," that in the direction that a person wants to travel, God allows you to go there. You're not pleased about it, but he won't stand in your way. And not only that, God doesn't even punish you immediately after you've eaten the burger, even though there should be an immediate price to pay for that type of action. And that's midah keneged midah. God normally acts midah keneged midah, measure for measure, but God sort of delays it, gives you an opportunity to do teshuva, gives you an opportunity to say sorry, gives you an opportunity to, if you're presented with the same situation on another occasion, to refuse it. God's restraint in this context is quite fact, absolutely amazing. Because the reality is, as the Ramchal says, in both the Derech Hashem and in Das Tevunas and in multiple other places on this very subject, that by sinning, you are using your intelligence. You rationalize it. It won't be so terrible. You use your intelligence, which is a gift from God. You're using your energy and your life force, which is a gift from God. You're using your environment and its resources, your money, the air you breathe, your senses, all gifts from God, all used to perform an aveira, all used to do something that God told you not to do and obviously doesn't want you to do. And despite the fact that the sinner can't exist without God propping him up moment by moment, God continues to prop him up, even while he's committing a sin. Just imagine, says the Ramchal, this man is sinning against God, and God is propping him up with life every second he's sinning. Is there any disgrace greater than that? Asks the Ramchal. Why would God do that? Why would God continue to prop you up so that you can continue to throw his gifts back in his face? And the answer is very simple. God is committed to us out of love. God is desperate that we shouldn't fail, that we should always be given another chance and another chance and another chance, a chance to do teshuva. At the end of the day, we get the opportunity every day, three times a day. We get the ultimate opportunity, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the Aseret Yemei Teshuva. And in fact, any minute of any day, you want to take out a book, the Machzor for Yom Kippur, and do vidui, and do make a confession to God, he's listening. And to think about it, it's absolutely amazing on the basis that the reality is we all know that you're going to do it again, or you're going to do something similar again. And yet God's prepared only to look at the past, look at the present, and we'll worry about the future later on. So this is the context into which God is speaking to the Jewish people. So back to the context here, from a historical perspective, what era are we discussing here, where all this type of thing happened, where they, we talked about the Egel Hazor, the golden calf, but some similar things were happening in Yerushalayim. So when did it all start? So the Malbim, as he did in verse 17, we've just done verses 18 and 19, but the Malbim says in verse 17, interestingly, he gives us some historical context regarding God's complaint here in verses 18 and 19. He writes that these verses are still discussing the era in Jewish history before everything fell apart. The period between King Rehoboam, who was the son of Shlomo HaMelech, the son of King Solomon, until the reign of the wicked King Ahaz. During this era, between 200 and 225, maybe 230 years, until around the year 550 BCE, you had the following examples of what God is complaining about in verses 18 and 19. So we have case number one, as the Malbim points out, the case of the mother of the righteous King Asa. Now, King Asa was one of the great tzaddikim, great righteous kings of Israel, righteous kings of the southern kingdom of Israel, Yehuda. He was a great grandson of Shlomo HaMelech. And it says about him and his mother. The mother wasn't no great metziah, right? So he was a great tzaddik. His mother, not so much. So it says there in Divrei HaYomim, in the book of Chronicles, in the second book of Chronicles in chapter 15, it says, V'gam ma'acha eim Asa HaMelech. Macha, King Asa's mother, Hisira Migvira, he deposed from being the queen. Like she was like the queen, the king's mother. Like you had in England before the queen mother died, you had the queen, Queen Elizabeth, before she died. And her mother was also called the queen mother. And she was also called Elizabeth. So at the time when King Assel was the king, so his mother was also a queen. She was the king's mother, and she was a queen. So Hisira he got rid of her. He got rid of her from being. He said, "You can't take any part in running the country anymore." Asher Osasol Asherah, because she made a monstrous image for the Asherah in order to commit sexual perversions with the tree. They used to carve phalluses, I think that's the correct word, into the tree, and the women used to mount the tree, and that's what his mother did. By Yichros, and so King Asa destroyed that image that she'd made. By Yodek, he crushed it. By Yisrof Benachal Kidron, and he burnt it and threw it into the Nachal Kidron. So that's why says the Malbim, that's why it says in verse 17, you made yourself male images and you fornicated with them. So this was the period. This was the period after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, and after the death between the period of Shlomo HaMelech's son, who also was no great Metzia, Rehoboam, till the time of King Ahaz. This is where we were slowly going downhill. But it wasn't just in the southern kingdom. Well, here's another example from the southern kingdom. So we had the case of the wicked queen Athaliah. Now, she was the wife of Jehoram. She was the seventh king, who was the seventh king of Judah. And again, in Divrei Hayomim, we have that story in the second book of Divrei Hayomim, chapter 24, and the case of Amatziah, who was the 11th king of Judah. So things are slowly going downhill. We learn about Atalia, the wicked Atalia, ki Ataliahu Hamirshas, the wicked Atalia, Bonel and her sons, Poritzu es Beis Elohim. They broke into the house of God. They broke into the temple. Vegam kod kol kodshei Beis Hashem osu labalim. And they used all the holy objects of the house of God to serve the Baal, to serve the idols. By Yehi, that's her. This is the queen. This is the queen, and she's the wife of Yehoram, the seventh king of Yehuda, and she's using the Beis HaMikdash for idolatry. And a short time later, we have the story of King Amatziah, the 11th king of Yehuda. By he achrei bo Amatziah mehakos Adomim. After Amatziah came back from war, after defeating the Edomites, by Yoveh Salhei B'nai Seir, he brought with him the gods, the sons of Seir, the sons of the gods of Edom. He brought with him, brought back from the battlefield. He just defeated them, so their gods weren't very good, but he brought their gods back in any case. By Yamidim Lo Lelohim, and he set themselves up. He set these idols up as gods. B'lifneim Yishtachav Lahem Yikoteh. And he prostrated himself before them, and he burnt incense to them. So God's getting a bit of a bad run here in the time between Shlomo HaMelech, the death of Shlomo HaMelech, and the time we come to Chizkiyahu HaMelech, 250 years later, things are steadily going downhill. And that's why God says here, regarding this story of Amatziah, B'shamni uk'tarati nosat lifneihem, who gave my oil and my incense to them. It was about the Malbim concludes these two verses. It says, "Behold us, by called Zebetzina." All these examples of paganism and perverted sexual activity, and many more besides. Betzina were activities that were done in private during this period. There was no public declaration of idol worship. It wasn't idol worship, was not the religion of the land. The religion of the land was Judaism, and as we discussed last week, it was a peculiar type of Judaism, because they tended to keep the mitzvahs in public, but in private they do all these types of perverted activity, worshiping idols, sexual impropriety, everything you wanted from a Jewish society. He says, "Well, calls us how you calls there, but sinner, but avodas Beis Hashem how you dying on machona." And coming up to the reign of King Ahaz, the services in the Beis HaMikdash were still ongoing. Yeah, there were people coming in there and doing things that they shouldn't be doing, but generally speaking, it was the era of the hybrid Jew, openly Jewish and privately practicing paganism and sexual perversions. So that's the period we're talking about, that God's talking about here. And now, as we come to verse 20 and verse 21, God takes it up a level, one more level, describing the goings on later on when we get to the period of King Ahaz. When we get to the period of King Ahaz, everything goes south because paganism starts to become national religion. It's brought out into the open. Everyone can get involved, and you can do it openly and publicly. But Tikri verses 20 and 21. But Tikri esbonayich veesbonosayich lohem lechol. This is a new type of idol worship. Well, not new, but it's something that they'd not done before, but they loved it. They wanted to get involved. You took your children, your sons and your daughters that you bore for me, and you sacrificed them to the idols. Lechol, to consume. Hama'at mitaznusoyech. Weren't those perversions of yours enough? Like what you were doing up till now, wasn't that enough? That you had to start off with this new thing, as we'll see what they were doing. But chishchatias bonai, you slaughtered my children. But titnim bahavioson lahem, and you gave them over by passing over to them, to the idols. So we'll see exactly what's going on here. It's a change of pace. Before it was all private, and they at least pretended to be Jewish. When King Ahaz became king, and remember, he's the father of King Chizkiyahu, one of the greatest righteous men, greatest tzaddikim in Jewish history. So it's an amazing thing, the kings of Yehuda. So it tended to be, the father was a tzaddik and the son was a rasha. Then the next generation was a tzaddik and the next generation was a rasha. He used to, backwards and forward like ping pong. One generation with a great king and then the next generation with a rotten king. And the amazing thing was that righteous kings tended to have rotten children and rotten kings tended to have righteous children. A very, very strange thing. So here, the Malbim tells us this is verses 20 and 21 take us through to the era of King Ahaz. Again, a terribly evil individual. And the verse says, Vatikri, our verse 20 says, Vatikri, you took, Ato Yisa, per Masha also b'mei Ochos. Now, God is describing what happened during the period when Ahaz was the king. Zora now Bafar Hesia, who worshipped, he didn't feel the need to, worship idols and become a pagan behind closed doors or in private. Bafar Hesia, he was doing it in public. So now that paganism was being practiced in public, high up on the list of communal pagan practice was the Avodah Zorah of Molech, which they'd never done before. And the king led the way themselves, as described in Malachim, exactly what this worship was. It's described in the Torah. By Yelech b'derech Malchi Yisrael v'gamis b'no hevi b'esh. Now, in the Northern Kingdom, this was already going on, but in the Southern Kingdom, this was something new. And Achaz, it says, by Yelech b'derech Malchi Yisrael v'gam b'no hevi b'esh. The way they served the Molech was that you took your son. And normally your firstborn son, but we'll see in Lav Dakha, not necessarily your firstborn son. And you put him, you made him walk through the fire of Molech, so that the child would get burnt to death. So this is what Ahaz wanted to do. Vayelech b'derech Malchi Yisrael v'gam es b'no hevi b'esh. He passed his son, who would become the great Chizkiyahu HaMelech, through the fire, k'sovos hagoyim, in the abominable manner of the nations, Asher Horish Hashem Osam, whom God had driven out before them, Ibnei B'nei Yisrael, whom God had driven out from before the Israelites. So now they're adopting pagan practices from everybody. As we'll see, there wasn't one nation in the whole area of the Near and Middle East, that the Jews didn't adopt their Avodah Zarah. What's interesting about the Jews is that the Philistines, and they kept their own religion. They had their own paganism, they kept their own religion. The Assyrians the same, the Babylonians the same, the Egyptians the same. They didn't bother with other people's religions. They bothered with their own religions. The Jews, of course, have got to be the same as everybody else, only more so. They've got to adopt, they've got their own religion, but they've got to adopt everybody else's paganism as well. They don't care. The Gemara in Beitza says the Jewish people are azim. I don't know what that word is in English. They're brazen. Brazen. Don't care. Don't care. They do be, they think, they speak before they think. They do before they think about it, and they don't care. They'll argue back to you. You miata. That's still present in the land of Israel today. Who the heck are you to tell me what to do? Miata. So this was the nature. So they adopted this pagan practice of taking your child and bringing him through the fire, and he tried to do it to his own son, to Chizkiyahu, the man that would be the great leader of Israel, that would defeat the Assyrians. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, on Daf Samach Gimel on the base on page 63, explains how great the future king of Yehuda was. And how Chizkiyahu survived this. His father took him and put him through the fire. So the Gemara says, Av Chizki, this is the Gemara in, again, Sanhedrin, Daf Samach Gimel. Av Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda, Bikesh Aviv Lasos Lokeh. That Achaz, the father of Chizkiyahu, the king of Yehuda, attempted to burn his son alive as an offering to the idol, to the Molech. Elosh so Imo Salamandra. But his mother rubbed the blood of the salamander. I don't know exactly what it means. She rubbed the blood of the salamander. The Gemara says it's a creature out of fire was created. It was a creature that was created at the time of the Bria, at the time of the creation. It was created out of fire and immune to the effects of fire. And so the blood of the salamander is fireproof. And his mother coated him from head to toe in the blood of the salamander, and he was saved. But his father took him. His father tried to kill him, tried to kill his own son. And that you should know, the Torah is very specific about this practice. The Torah knew all about it. The Torah knew all about it 700 years before Achaz started to practice it in Yerushalayim. The Torah says in Vayikra, we'll be coming to it in a few weeks, in Vayikra chapter 18, and Rizara Cholos Itaim Lahavi Lamolech. You're not allowed to give any of your offerings or to pass through the fires of the Molech. Lo Sachala Hashem Elokecha Ani Hashem. And you will not profane my name, I am God. So it's interesting that this practice, so they had plenty of idols as we'll see later on. They had all the idols of the Philistines, they had all the idols of Egypt, they had all the idols of the Babylonians, they loved it. But now they got a new toy to play with, the Molech. And everyone came, it was like a night out, it was like a ceremony. The only problem was you had to sacrifice a child and put him through the fire and burn him to death. So everyone loved it. Well, who wouldn't love something like that? So this is just indication of how low the Jewish people had sunk. The Medrash in Eicha on the Book of Lamentations, which of course describes the great sadness of the destruction of the first temple. The Medrash there describes how the public Molech ceremony took place in Israel in Achaz's day. And everybody loved it. This was like a Super Bowl night. So the Gemara, the Medrash says, Omar Rabbi Yossi says, Begay ben Chinon, in the valley of Chinon, there was a hollow, and they built an idol there, an idol there, that was placed behind seven partitions. There was a bronze tray in the hand of the idol, and there was a stove placed upon it. For everyone who sacrificed fine flour to the idol, they would open one partition. for him, so he could see part of the, like the partition, like the mechitza, covered the idol. He couldn't see the idol. So if your brother, if you bought a, you see those games where they, if you answer a question right, so you take, you got a picture and the picture's completely covered up. And so if you answer a question right, so they take a piece off the picture and you got to guess what the picture is. And every time you answer a question, you take another piece off the top and you, you get a better idea of what's underneath. This is, so you had this idol that was completely covered up and it had seven partitions, like seven barriers to it. So people would come and offer things to the idol, to the Molech. And if you brought sacrificed fine flour, they removed one partition. If you sacrificed a pigeon or a turtle dove, they removed two partitions. If you brought a sheep, they removed three partitions. So now you're getting a much better view of the idol itself. If you brought a ram, they would open up four partitions. If you offered a calf, they would open up five partitions. A bull, six partitions. And anyone who would sacrifice their own son, they would open up all seven partitions, revealing the idol in all its glory. They'd place the child in the bronze tray in the idol's hand and ignite the stove beneath him. They would sing loudly and praise the Molech and praise the father and say to the father, Yerav lecha v'yivusom lach. May this worship be pleasant for you and sweet for you. Why did they sing, says the Medrash? Why did they sing and praise the father so loudly? Like they were all shouting and screaming and singing songs. Why did they do that, says the Medrash? So that they would not have to listen to the moaning of their sons as they were being burnt to death and then want to change their minds about having offered their own children. The Medrash continues, on one occasion, a pagan priest came to a man and said to him, I've come to you because the idol Molech said to me, appeared to me, with all the sons that you have, don't you want to sacrifice one to them? The man replied to him, all my children are needed. They're all working to make parnassa for the family. And in any case, they're all pagans already. And so the galach, the pagan priest, was disappointed. So the Medrash says that the father thought about it again for a few minutes and then said to the priest, the pagan priest, wait a second. I have a young son who is in school learning Torah. When he comes home, I will give him over to you to sacrifice in the fires of the Molech. And on that, God said, wicked one, of all the five sons that you have, four of whom are pagans, did you need to throw to the idol Molech, the one who is devoted to my name, the one who learns Torah? Says the Medrash, Omar Rav Yudin Bar Shimon, B'shem Reb Levi ben Parota. This is analogous to a noblewoman whose lover said to her, prepare some hot water for me for a bath. So she took the king's laurel wreath and used it, broke it up and used it for fuel to heat the water for him so he could have a bath. And then the king said to her, of all the wood that is in this house and of all the wood that is in this world, did you need to heat the water for your lover using the wood from my royal wreath? So too, God said to the wicked men, of all the sons that you have, did you have to throw to the idol and burn alive the one who is devoted to my name, the one who learns Torah? And that is, says the Medrash, that's what Yechezkel is saying here in chapter 16, verse 20. V'atichi es bonech, bonayich, you took your sons, the Espinosaich, and your daughters, Asher Yolad to Li, that you bore for me, those that were learning Torah, those that were dedicated to me, Batizbechim Lohem Lechol, and you sacrificed them for the idols to consume. And this story, now whether it's true story in the Medrash or not, it's irrelevant whether it's true, but it characterizes the nature of what was going on in Yerushalayim at this particular time in history. Remember, this is just 130 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. I'll say it's only 130 years, but things are going to go even further downhill from there. Like, how can they possibly go any further downhill from here? like the sacrificing their own children to an idol. But it's going to go worse. It's going to get worse. So whether the story in the Medrash is true or it's just an allegory, it's just a euphemism for what was going on in Yerushalayim at the time of King Ahaz. No, whatever it was, the story in the Midrash encapsulates to a T the schizophrenic nature and the paradox of the Jews living during this period of Jewish history. Just think about and examine the logic of these parents. They're living a hybrid religious life. On the one hand, they believe in God, and they send their children to a Jewish school to receive a Jewish education. On the other hand, they enjoy the pagan lifestyle, involving themselves in pagan rituals and abominations that type of activity entails.
Rabbi, sorry to interrupt you. Is there any connection between sacrificing your children as you accounted and eating your children under the temple siege?
No, not at this stage. No, this is no, they're not connected. This is a completely different type of that was out of necessity of that was out in the necessity of staying alive. This was completely voluntary. This is a completely voluntary action that they were
But
doing that.
if we carry this forward, one of the things that lead to the downfall of the Jewish people is what they did with their children. I hear it all the time growing up that how the child grows up is how he's raised. The abandonment of Torah today that is so rampant is because the children weren't given a Torah education.
Say that again, sorry.
I'm
Just read.
thinking about the American experience. We have a lost generation, started with my mother's generation. And one of the reasons forwarded was that there was a lack of Jewish education, where today there are Jewish kids that never saw Torah.
Yeah. No, it's always the death knell of Judaism. Education, education, education. No, always. If there's no Jewish education, there's no Jews 3 generations, 2 generations later.
Don't you see the connection between sacrificing your children? It's a voluntary act. In effect, Jewish parents who don't provide a Jewish education, how are they different than those who you
I understand what you're saying, and this is something that Reb Chaim Brisker talks about. I mean, not in not. I mean, this is in the 21st century. This is what Reb Chaim Brisker said is not really politically correct. He when he was talking about Zionism, the early years of Zionism, and he said pretty much what you're saying now. He's saying, Zionism is you might as well die. You might as well be offered to an avodah zarah. Better to die now, sinless, and go through life as a Zionist and get the full wrath of God when you die. So, well, that's one approach. I suppose you're right. If you look at Hitler wanted to destroy the Jews, physically kill them, annihilate them, gas them all to death, burn them alive. But if you look at the American experience, pretty much that's what the Jewish people have done to themselves, not physically, but spiritually, just decapitated themselves. And is there a difference between the two? Is that what you're asking? I don't know. I don't know. They both lead to the same thing. They both lead to the death of Judaism and the removal of Jewish souls.
Yeah, there's one last point. There's an irony. We have this part of our faith is to remember our parents, Yahrzeit. There's no Yahrzeit among those Jews who fell away. There's no Yahrzeit. They don't remember.
They're gone. I mean, we know this. I mean, we know that at the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, there was almost as many Jews in the world as there were Chinese. Look at the world today. Look at the world today. Look at There's 1.4, 1.5, 1.6 billion Chinese. Where are all the Jews? Yeah. They're gone. And the attitude of God is pretty much, I mean, like sign house. The attitude of God is pretty much this. If you're not keeping the Torah, we don't need you. Bye bye. And that's a very harsh thing to say, but that's been God's approach all the way along. Ma'at mikol hagoyim. You'll be the smallest among the nations. You don't want to keep the Torah, you want to reject the Torah, good. Bye bye. Two generations later, you're gone from history. Your family line's gone from history. Your bloodline's gone from history, from Jewish history. Bye bye. And in that respect, God's is true to his word. But nichrasa nefesh, that's what it means in the Torah. The nichrasa, you're gone. Cut off. Disappear. Gone from the bloodline. Don't need you. If you're not going to keep the Torah, we don't need you. Go be somebody else. And pretty much that's the American experience to a certain extent. It's starting to change a little bit, but you have to reach the bottom. The train has to reach the bottom of the hill before it can stabilize. But pretty much that's it. A physical death, a spiritual death. What's the difference? I don't know. And I wouldn't like to comment. It's not my business to comment on that type of thing. But there's a spiritual holocaust that went on, throughout the Enlightenment, throughout the early part of the American experience, and not just America, UK, Europe, Australia, Canada, South Africa to a much lesser extent. Majority of South Africans are, if not observant, but certainly traditional. And you find in America that there's no traditionalism at all. Almost not. If you're a traditional Jew in America, you're frum. If you're not frum, so you're not even traditional. Like, there's no middle ground. Whereas to a certain extent in Britain, the British Commonwealth, you still have that, particularly in South Africa. But spiritual death against the physical death, which is worse? I don't know. The Brisker said it's better to die young. Physically die young before you get yourself before you go down that track, because at least you go up to God pretty much free of sin. But if you spend your life, if you disappear from Judaism and you bring in non-Jewish children into the world and you reject your Judaism and you're a disgrace to, I mean, you see it online all the time now, self-hating Jews. We've suffered from them for hundreds of generations. But that's it. They reject Judaism, and the worst enemies of the Jewish people are Jews that reject Judaism. Starting off with the Crusades, not the Crusades, starting off early on, time of the Torah. People in the desert, self-hating Jews. You have it throughout Jewish history. The worst was at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. The original inquisitors were all descendants of Jews or Jews themselves, converts to Catholicism. Anyway, back to the subject at hand. So you've got these people that are living a hybrid life. It's really quite hard to understand the logic of these parents. They're living a hybrid religious life. They believe in God. They send their children to Jewish schools. On the other hand, they enjoy pagan lifestyle, involving themselves in pagan rituals to the extent that they're prepared to sacrifice their own children. They know that worshipping and taking part in pagan rituals, and particularly Molech, involves sacrificing a child to be burned to death to appease a god, a stone, or whatever it was made out of. We know from the historical accounts of Molech worship, the optimal way to worship this idol was to sacrifice your best, most valued child to the idol. So what did these people do? They would sacrifice their most prized, cherished child to the idol, the one that was learning Torah, the one that was frum, rather than any of the children who were already pagans. And the dichotomy here, the contradiction here, is clear to see. On the one hand, you've got people believing in God and the Torah, so that they understand that their most prized child is the child that can learn Torah. On the other hand, because they enjoy the pagan lifestyle, they're prepared to sacrifice that most valued child to the idol, because that's what is expected as part of this pagan worship. How do you rationalize this? And it goes beyond logic, right? It just goes beyond logic. So the result is that we can see a picture here, and we're talking about the year 550, the time of Ahaz, again, about 130 years before the destruction of a totally schizophrenic society that sees no contradiction between the value they place on Torah study and the Torah itself and mitzvahs and the worship of pagan gods, to the extent they're prepared to sacrifice the children, their own children, to their idols. And this complex, contradictory and irrational nature of Jewish society at the time of King Ahaz reinforces a statement from the Gemara. There's a statement in the Gemara on Daf Gimel, right at the start of Sotah on Daf Gimel. The Gemara says, Reish Lakish Omer, Ein Adam Ovar Aveira and Kein Nichnas Baruch Shtus. A man commits a transgression against God only if a spirit of shtus, a spirit of idiocy, foolishness, enters him. And you have to be completely illogical. You have to be completely illogical to believe in God and believe in the Torah and believe in mitzvahs and be a pagan at the same time. How do you put that together? So the Akedas Yitzchok, Rabbeinu Yitzchok ben Moshe Arama, one of the great Jewish philosophers, lived in the 15th century, died in 1494. He explains this Gemara, that Ein Odom Ovar Aveira Lim Kein Nichnas Baruch Shtus, that it's only possible to do an Aveira unless you're an idiot, unless some spirit of foolishness, idiocy, Shtus, enters you. So he explains, and tell what he says about this Gemara. He says, Ein Odom Ovar Aveira Lim Kein Nichnas Baruch Shtus, that a man that can't sin unless he's temporarily taken leave of his senses. He writes, if this is indeed true, we must ask that if sin is a result of functional disability of the mind, how can a person be held responsible for such a sin? Well, the Gemara is saying that you must, if you're going to do an Aveira, certainly something as illogical and as reprehensible as sacrificing your own child, you're obviously taking leave of your senses. And if you've taken leave of your senses, how can you be held responsible for the sin? Because you've obviously lost your mind. He says the dilemma can be resolved in the following manner. He says we need to know that throughout Jewish history, there have always been three categories of people. He says the first category is composed of people in whom the intellect is predominant and governs practically all their activities, so that for them, sinning is almost inconceivable. The second group comprises people who are so enslaved to their physical urges that their intellect is for all practical purposes paralyzed. Can't resist. See a beautiful woman, you can't resist. You see a cheeseburger, you can't resist. You see, you want to go to the ball game on Shabbos, you can't resist. You're a slave to your physical urges. That's another group of people. He says, but in the middle is a third group, which comprises the vast majority of Jews, who face an ongoing confrontation between their physical urges, the Yetzirah, and their intellect, which he categorizes as the Yetzirah, the urge to do the right thing. All the people belonging to this latter group suffer from the fact that gratification of one's urges is immediate or almost immediate. On the other hand, the price to be paid for having gratified one's urges is usually sometimes in the future, and therefore not of immediate concern. The reward for acting in accordance with the dictates of the Yetzer Tov, the dictates of one's intellect, may be quite some time away. For that reason, such an eventual reward may not play a decisive role when a decision is made between conflicting choices available. The reason that God has arranged matters in such a way is due to the fact that otherwise, Bechira, free choice, would not be a viable option. In order to demonstrate that it does not pay to give in to physical passion and sin when it leads to the performance of immoral acts, we have the example of the Sota as a warning. Remember, what happens to her Not now, but eventually, when she has to drink the bitter soda waters, and if she's found guilty of having been immoral, what happens to her? So, you know, it's easy to understand, right? It's easy to understand that you can rationalize it, that you can do something wrong, and you're not going to be punished now, right? You might be punished. You can sit in the sun all day during the summer, and everybody knows you've got a chance of getting skin cancer, right? But you're not going to get skin cancer today. So you rationalize it. So, you know, I'll sit today and I won't sit tomorrow. And you'll say the same thing tomorrow. And that's what it's like with sin. You get this disconnect between the intellect and what you know rationally is stupidity. But you give in to the stupidity because acting rationally, the reward might be a lifetime away. Acting irrationally, the gratification is now, this minute. And so this is the breakdown, he says. This is the breakdown in the forces of the Yetzirah and the Yetzirah. This is why it convinces you, even though it's illogical, even though it's irrational, even though it would appear on the surface you're losing a leave of your senses. If you enjoy it, so you enjoy it now, maybe do teshuva tomorrow. Maybe it won't happen. Who says it's going to happen? So which of these three groups did the Jews at the time of Achaz fit into? What group do we fit into? Remember, he's saying here, he says you've got one group composed of people whose intellect is predominant and governs all their activities. So sin is almost inconceivable. So nobody fits, very, very few people that fit into that group. You got the second group that comprises of people who are so enslaved to their physical urges they can't resist. And their intellect is, for all practical purposes, paralyzed. So that's another group. That's the other extreme. What about the group that, you know, you can talk yourself into believing, yeah, well, I'll get away with it today. Maybe I'll do teshuva, or, you know, maybe it'll never happen. Maybe I won't get cancer. Maybe, you know, maybe the water isn't poisoned. And you get away with it. And because the rewards for doing something good is, it could be a lifetime away. It could be the next world. Who need? Well, I need it now. So which of these three groups did Achaz fit into? And what group do we fit into? Here, in 2024, what group do we fit into? So the answer is this. Elio Hanavi gave us the answer. Elio Hanavi summed up the Jewish people's self-deception when he said, you know, I mean, the Haftorah, we say, after we read about the sin of the golden calf and Parashas Kisisa, again, we read this parasha a few weeks ago. And we read this Haftorah a few weeks ago. Malachim, the first book of Malachim, chapter 18, 21. The question that every Jew should ask themselves every single day, every single minute of every day, when, you know, they're attracted to something they know that is inappropriate. Vayigash Elio, this is Elio speaking. Remember, Elio is no friend of anybody's. Elio Hanavi is not your grandfather. Your loving grandfather. Elio Hanavi tells you it's straight. He's not interested in he's not interested in excuses. He's going to tell you it's straight. He's not Moshe Rabbeinu. And he's certainly not any of the other prophets. He's a unique character in Jewish history who everything he does is for God. He's not interested in the Jews in that respect. The only thing he's interested in with the Jews is that they do the right thing for the sake of God. Everything's for the sake of God. Vayigash Elio el Kolah. Elijah, the prophet, Elio, approached the people and said, Vayomra ad mosai atem poskim al shteis ha-se'ifim. How long are you going to hop between two ideas? Im Hashem olakim l'chu acharov. Use your intellect. If God is God, follow him. V'im Baal l'chu acharov. And if the Baal is God, follow him. And the people did not say a word. They weren't prepared to commit. Because the reality is that we belong in this third group. Because there are certain situations that, you know, we're not out and out sinners. We're not desperate to sin. But we are human beings. And we've got the ability to rationalize things in a totally rational way, which is exactly what the Gemara says here. This is exactly what Reish Lakish says here. Everybody's got that ability to incorporate into his rationalization about an action something that he knows deep down, he knows it's nonsense. He knows it's irrational. He knows it goes against everything he really believed in. And yet we still do it. We're still capable of doing it. That was the stage the Jewish people were at this point in time. They were at that point. They'd gone, they're in group two. They'd gone from group one where it was incapable. They were incapable of doing sin in the desert, pretty much for 40 years. Okay, we hear all the stories about the spies and everything else, but you remember the 40 years in the desert, and maybe they did five or six things wrong in 40 years. So, you know, it sounds a lot because that's the thing that the Torah focuses on. It doesn't focus on the other 39 and a half years that they kept, that they, you know, they were good, Odei Hashem, that they did everything that was right. The Torah focuses on everything they did wrong. So they've gone from that first category of people where their intellect is predominant and governs practically all their activities. So sin is almost inconceivable. And now they've got to this third stage. They've got to a third stage where, you know, they can be talked to, they can talk themselves into doing these absolutely irrational and illogical things. But eventually they're going to reach the third stage. They're going to eventually, after another 100 years, they're going to reach which is the second group, which is what the Akedah Yitzchak describes here. As the second group comprises of people who are so enslaved to their physical urges that their intellect is, for all practical purposes, paralyzed, finished, gone. And that's the point they're going to reach. They're not there yet, but that's the point they're going to reach. So that's where we're going to leave it. And what's coming up next is God describing to them in verse 22, which is where we're up to, verse 22, where we'll pick up next week. God's going to describe to them that it's very easy to forget, right? It's very easy to forget. You know, you get into a marriage, lo aleinu, and a couple are getting divorced. So it's very hard for them to think about their courtship and their engagement and their wedding day, right? Those things, they have to dismiss those from their minds because now it's all out war. And they're getting divorced and they're going to talk about the money and the, you know, who's going to get access to the children. And all the good things of the past are shoved to a side, thrown in the bin. And this is what God says here in verse 22, which is what we'll deal with next time. I'll just read it to you. There's kol tov asayich v'sasn asayich. All your abominations and all your perversions, lo zochart. You didn't remember. You forgot. As you may know, the days of your youth, the Yosech Aaron Ve'eria, when you were naked and bare, Mr. Veves Bedomech Hayis, and you were wallowing in your own birth blood. You don't remember. I picked you up. I cared for you. I brought you up. And you don't remember those days. No, you don't remember those days now because those days of poverty and deprivation are long gone. You're a superstar now. You're the Jewish people. You're Israel. You're a mighty nation. You're affluent. You're the military power. You're a superpower. So you don't remember you don't remember the father that brought you up and clothed you and saved your life when you were a baby. Yeah, don't remember about that because we're getting divorced now. So who needs to remember about that? So that is the starting point in verse 22, which we will pick up, please God, mitzvah Hashem, next week in health and happiness, please God. Everyone should have a great week and enjoy Shushan Pirim. Have a great, don't drink too much, guys. Jeff Wilt, don't drink too much, man. Joan Roth, don't leave the booze alone, girl. Leave the booze alone. Okay. Good night. God bless. Kol Tov to everybody. Have a great week. I'll see you next week. Same time, same place. Kol Tov.
Ta-da.